Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Yeah, I am the David Koresh of sustainability. No.
Yeah, that sounds great.
That'll be quoted. I'm great. long live Bavar Christiania.
Hi, I'm Helen Holliman, editor-in-chief of Munchies, and welcome back to Munchies, the podcast. So we've left LA, we hit the airport's duty-free shops, and we've just touched down in the world's food capital, aka Copenhagen. To get this visit started, I'm meeting up with Matt Orlando, owner and head chef of the incredible, super ambitious restaurant Amas. When Matt first arrived in Copenhagen over 10 years ago, he immediately headed to its infamous Christiania neighborhood. And today, that's exactly where he's taking me. Christiania is a squat in the center of Copenhagen, or at least it started out as one. Back in the early 70s, hippies, anarchists, and soon-to-be punks began taking up residence in what was then an abandoned military zone. Four decades later, this community soldiers on, with nearly 1,000 permanent residents maintaining Christiania while rebuking the government's efforts to exercise control over the independent microstate. So we settle into a cafe along the infamous Pusher Street. Matt Orlando is sitting across from me. He holds the distinction of having worked at some of the world's most renowned restaurants. He's been at Le Bernardin and Per Se in New York, the Fat Duck in London, and he was also head chef at Noma. A few years ago, Matt decided to strike out on his own here in Copenhagen, using all of the experience he's gained at those incredible restaurants to open his own. He might be taking a few subconscious cues from Christiania, but he's trading the hippie BO for the fresh scent of compost. So can you describe where we are exactly?
Everyone basically says it's a free town. So this is in the middle of Copenhagen, which Denmark itself is somewhat of a conservative country. But ironically, in the center of the Copenhagen, there is a portion of the city that was taken over by hippies in the 60s when the military moved out, and they've just basically squatted, and they're still here. The government let them stay. They have their own laws, their own rules, their own trash system, their own, it's, they don't pay taxes, and you can buy weed and hash on the streets here. That's not the main reason I come here.
So tell me about the first time that you came to Christiania. What was it like?
Oh, man. It was... I had just moved to Copenhagen. It was 2005. And I came here with a friend named Tim, who was a... Living with him for 6 months, took 10 years off my life. He liked to have a good time. And we came here at night, and I walked in here, and I... You know, when you first move to Europe as an American, everything is cool. Even if it's really shitty, it's cool because you're not so European. The apartment I lived in, you have to walk down 5 floors and take a shower in the basement. And I was so stoked because it was, I thought, this is European, man. This is... So I came here for the first time. It was just, I couldn't believe. I'm from San Diego where, I mean, smoking weed is like drinking a beer. But to come to a place where it was just so open and free and people just walking around and... It was amazing. I feel like I belonged here. It's everything that's missing in San Diego.
So do you remember what you did that first day when you came out here?
Yeah, I smoked weed. Then I don't remember what happened after that.
Fair. So, you know, you've been in Copenhagen for quite a while now. And, you know, tell me about, like, the first year that you were here. What was it like for you transitioning from the American restaurant scene into...
Well, I kind of had a softer transition because I was actually working in England for a year before I made it to Copenhagen. And the restaurant I came from, the Fat Duck in England. It was amazing in so many ways, like technique-wise, but it wasn't product-focused, and I was really looking for something that was new and modern. My training had been really classical before the Fat Duck, so I was really looking for this mesh between modern food but really product-driven. And when I came to Copenhagen for the first time, I was just coming for a week just to hang out, and I ended up staying for 2 years. And because I started at Noma, and that's when Noma was... It had been open for like a year and a half when I started, and it was exciting because it was a restaurant that had never really existed before, and we were kind of trying to figure it out, and we were made fun of. I mean, our nickname within... At that time in Copenhagen, all the top restaurants were French and Italian, and really looking to the south of Europe for inspiration, and we were really looking for to the north of Europe. And the nickname in the city... everyone called us the seal fuckers because we were, oh, do you cook with seal blubber? And so it was an exciting time because we were just on kind of uncharted territory.
So what was it that made you want to stay in Copenhagen?
I think it was amazing because you could feel something was kind of bubbling in the restaurant scene. And also coming from England just kind of felt a little bit like, I mean, all my English friends are going to kill me for saying this, but an extension of America. And coming to Copenhagen was such a European feeling, had such a European feeling to it. And just, it was old too. There were so many, I mean, the apartment I lived in was 350 years old. It was amazing. And that's older than the United States. It was... And the history and the there was just so much history and culture here, and it was an amazing and I just met really cool people right when I got here, and I think that was a big part of it as well. But the restaurant scene was something was happening, and you could feel it. There was something exciting going on, and so it was. I just wanted to be a part of that. I mean, and all my friends back home were like, "What the? You're leaving the Fat Duck?" That was the 2005, the year I was there. It was the year we got number one in the world too. And they're like, "You're leaving the Fat Duck to move to Denmark? Was that the capital of Sweden? What is..." Like, all my friends back home were like, "What are you doing?" But I just, there was like a feeling inside me that I had to be here. Everyone here, I mean, I've worked in big cities, and in most big cities it's more about one-upping the next guy and stealing his cooks and stealing his ideas. And here it's everyone just collaborates, everyone's friends. I think the city is too small to really have any of that negative kind of back and forth.
I think one of the most amazing things about this city to me is that there's so much focus on New Nordic that people seem to have a perception that maybe it's these dogmatic hipster Vikings that speak a secret language that nobody else can penetrate. But actually, you go into a kitchen in Copenhagen, Danes are the minority. It's made up of such a interesting multicultural mix that...
So that's Lars Hennerskov Eriksson. He's our Munchies Denmark editor.
Which I think is hugely beneficial.
Yeah. You know, if you go to... It's funny because I talked to a lot of the guests, and they're like, "Oh, wow, you... I haven't really had one..." Because all the chefs serve the food at a mass, and there's no... I keep, like, Australians are coming out, and people from New Zealand, and English, and Canadian, like... I don't know, are there any Danes that work here? We're like, well, we have one Dane in the kitchen. And it's funny because if you look at the majority of the top restaurants that are kind of in the limelight in Copenhagen, they're all run by foreigners. And it's this kind of weird... It's this weird kind of situation where, you know, this food revolution is happening in Denmark, in Copenhagen, but it's kind of, I mean, I don't say this in a negative way, it's just factual, it's kind of happening without the Danes. And it's something that, I mean, I've talked to a couple journalists, and they really want to write about it. They don't know how to write about it without sounding negative, because it's not, I don't think it's a negative thing. I think it's cool that there's all these foreigners that are coming here, and that's not to say it's all the restaurants are run by foreigners. I mean, there's some really, like Studio and Cadeau, and these are all Danish, that are that are running this that have kind of left and come back and are doing something really cool. It is true, like a lot of the top restaurants, English is the spoken language in the kitchen because there's so many foreigners that are coming here to work now, which I think adds, like Lars said, adds a real kind of eclectic mix to the restaurant scene here. You have all these people that aren't from here that are coming here to work. So, of course, they're going to kind of gravitate towards other foreigners that are here working as well because they all have that kind of being away from home situation in common. And so the restaurant community is super tight outside of the restaurants. Kind of if you go to on a Sunday, if you go to the market, if you haven't seen somebody in a long time and you want to see them, you just go to the market on Sunday. And chances are at one point they're going to be there. Specifically at Hija de Sanchez, the taco spot. Yeah. So but it's that also sense of community. Like I know, because a lot of people, they won't just come here to work at one restaurant. They'll come here and they'll kind of, over 3 or 4 years, they'll kind of move around and work at different restaurants. So in doing that, you meet so many people that are also doing the same thing. And there's like, it's very ancestral here. Everyone just kind of switches, exchanges cooks and people move around and stuff like that. So I think that's one of the coolest parts about Copenhagen and the restaurant scene here is that it's just such a diverse community.
So you have a very interesting relationship with your compost.
Oh, yes.
Actually, I want to ask you, Lars, how would you describe the experience of walking into the backyard at a Amas to see what's growing out there and how it all works?
I suppose it's a bit like going into a botanical garden rather than a restaurant. It's kind of amazing as a diner to go somewhere where there is that much attention to every single process. I mean, some people might think, oh, what the hell, I just want to eat nice food. I don't care what these guys are doing. But if you just has a, you know, if you have a tiny little bit of interest in what goes into the food that you eat, it's kind of amazing. And you don't understand the half of it because there are fish pooping in the water and that somehow turns into nutrients that then feed the plants. And then you get these beautiful little micro seeds and... Yeah, I think it's quite astonishing to witness it. And also just to see it as a diner, just to feel it, smell it, and taste it. Is especially smelling the compost, the love of your life.
Oh, yeah.
I know. How does your wife feel about that?
She's getting used to this kind of threesome relationship that is going on right now.
So walk me through your actual compost because you have an incredibly complex system and then describe how that's actually...
Well, so the last 3 years have been this kind of exploration of how do we ourselves deal with the amount of organic kind of stuff we would throw away. How do we deal with this and how do we process it? And I was so naive in the beginning. I would just throw it in a container and let it sit and that's what's going to happen and you have compost. And that is far from what happens when you do compost. It's like this constant, it's like having a pet or a wife. No, I'm joking. Joking. I love you, honey. Our zero waste policy is so aggressive and we're really using everything.
No, I was just thinking, is there anything you don't throw out? Because I noticed this last time you seem to recycle tea bags and candle lights.
Yeah, I mean, Jens, so I'll just give you some numbers right now because I just gave a talk in Malmo about running a sustainable restaurant in the future and I had done a bit of logging of how our waste is distributed. And the average restaurant produces 68,200 kilos of waste a year. Of that, 84% goes to the landfill, and 16% goes to recycling. At a mass, we produce 43,200 kilos of waste a year, so about 20,000 less. 22% goes to the landfill and 78% goes to recycling.
Wow.
Whether it's through the compost or we separate all of our hard plastic, soft plastic, metals, porcelain, our non-compostable food waste gets taken by a company that puts it through a fermentation process and traps the methane and turns it into biofuel. Like it's so we've kind of switched or flipped the numbers. And I really don't feel like we're even close to being where we can be.
It sounds very Christiania.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Long live Bavar Christiania.
So going back to this idea of, you know, getting the staff on board, you know, how do you do that without sounding like David Koresh, like, come into my cult and, you know, what is it that you tell them?
You sound exactly like that. And the people, that the good ones, they come. yeah, I think it's really about the people you hire. And I think the hiring process, I mean, I say the hiring process, but it's pretty limited because we've really only had one person in the kitchen leave since we started and one person in the dining room leave since we opened in 3 years. So we don't really have a really...
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A program for hiring people. We've hired a few people since then, but most of the people we've worked with before, and it's most people we've hired because I know they have the personality to kind of carry this torch and buy into it. I think we probably almost hire more on personality than skill, because you can teach a skill, but you can't teach someone open-mindedness. And it's a big part that I remember hiring the first cook in the kitchen after Scotty had left, who was the one cook that's left in the kitchen. And I was super nervous about hiring someone because we just had such a synergy in the kitchen. And then, I mean, we had a few people come in for trials and I just wasn't feeling it. And there was this guy staging he was there for 2 months. And I just remember he was an American, worked in New York for a long time. And we were up in the dry storage. He was cleaning the dry storage, and I was kind of going through the pickle fridge. And we were just having small talk. And I said, so where are you going after this? And he said, oh, I'm going to Miami, and then I'm coming back to Relay, and I plan on being in Europe for like 6 months. And he was American. I said, 6 months? How can you – he was a really good guy. And I said, how can you stay in America Europe for 6 months? You're only allowed here 90 days. He goes, oh, my dad is Swiss. I have a Swiss passport. And I was like, oh, really? So then I wooed him, took him out in the garden. It was late summer, a beer, and just had a chat after service on a Saturday night about what he wanted to do, and
showed him your compost.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
yeah.
Put your hands in the compost and just rubbed it all over your face.
Very,
and
very erotic. Me and the compost. I know, and I just asked him, "Are you looking for a job?" And he says, "I'm always looking for the right job," and he stayed. And it's a year later, he's still there.
Wow. So, you know, thinking about restaurants and sustainability in general, why do you think it's such a tough thing to champion for a lot of restaurants that are out there beyond Copenhagen?
I really think people think that it's going to cost them a lot of money to change to this way of working. And it doesn't cost you really any money. It costs you a little bit of work in the beginning, like I said before, but it's really, if you commit to it, and it's not, and you don't kind of keep looking back and say, oh, it'd be so much easier if we did it like this. You have to commit 150% to it, because it is, you have to switch your mind, your way of thinking, and it's not just like separating your waste and saving water and stuff like that. It's really also looking at the real way to combat this is looking at the way you cook. That's the core of it. I mean, like I said before, we're producing 6 times less organic waste because of just the way we're cooking and looking at our products and examining the whole product. Like an example I gave in this talk last week is that I said, you know, when we get a carrot in, the first thing we do, we don't even look at the carrot. We flip it upside down and take a bite of the greens. Okay, where can we go? Because we know the carrot's going to... That's the easiest part to work with. But what do we do with the greens? And we've really... About 6 months ago, we came into this technique where we're using all the stems left after we pick grains, and then the tops of different plants that are usually could be a little tough or something when you eat them. And we add 2% salt to the weight of this stuff, lactic ferment them for 5 days, dry them and grind them to a powder, and it tastes like seaweed.
Do you ever get worried that maybe some of this environmental focus takes focus away from what's essentially the most important thing of a dish, which is deliciousness?
Delicious.
Or what you eat. I mean, it's fantastic that parsley stems can be turned into something that is almost as umami-rich as seaweed. But is it a compromise sometimes to do this? Or do you feel like you're not getting the perfect ingredient?
No, I think it, like I said before, in the beginning when we started doing this, I think we did compromise sometime because we wanted to use everything. And of course we're still making good food, but I feel now that instead of being forced to do something with a byproduct, our brains are working in a much better way. Now we really examine the byproduct and study it and figure out, okay, the thought process basically goes like this. You have a byproduct, we look at it, and the first thing we look at is, why is this a byproduct? What about it is unattractive to people? Then we spend all of our time trying to fix what is unattractive about it and make it delicious, whether it's the bitterness, whether it's the sandiness, whether it's the texture. Then we go after that element and make it delicious. And in saying that, we would never just do something to do it. It has to be delicious. That's the most important thing now. And I think in working this way, it influences the way we cook. And we don't have like the main product and we're like, oh shit, now we have this byproduct. We have to use it. What do we have to do with it? Now it's kind of, okay, this is the dish we're going to put on. This is the byproduct that it creates. We're not putting this dish on until we figure out a delicious way to handle the byproduct. And then that's how the process goes.
What's a dish currently on the menu that is a great example of that?
So we have a product. It's called Back School. And this is it's a salted and smoked and dried fish that's really... It's an old technique that they've done in Denmark, up in the north of Denmark. They have these old smokehouses, and that's where they do it. It's a flatfish, like a plaice. And a lot of people just get it in, take all the flesh off, and just use the bones to like infuse it into a sauce to make it smoky, this kind of smoky fish, and it's delicious. But essentially, you're taking this whole fish and just extracting some smoky flavor out of it and then discarding the whole fish. We have basically taken the whole fish. The bones, obviously, we use to infuse into stocks. And then after that, okay, now we have the flesh. So we grind the flesh, and then we freeze it. No, sorry, freeze it, grind it, and then we into hot oil and deep fry it, and it becomes this smoked fish crumble. The skin we take, we infuse it into a neutral oil, and we toss cherries and yogurt curd and horseradish in it for this little kind of salad with fresh beans. The bones, after we make the stock, we cook it 80 degrees overnight on steam, and then the next day dry them and then deep fry them, and they become completely soft and crispy. So that's an ingredient I really feel like we've conquered. Like literally nothing goes into the garbage. And then just in relationship to the farmers, when Amass opened, I really wanted to work in a different way than I had worked in the past. I didn't want to tell the farmers like what to give us and what size. I wanted the farmers to tell us what was the best at that particular time. And you know, you can have a vegetable in season for 2 months, but there's only like a small kind of time period within that 2 months that they are like peaking, and that's when we want them. And if you tell the farmers, you know, that's when we want them, and I don't care if it's 10 kilos or 5 kilos or whatever, and I don't care what size they are, the farmers get really excited about that because they're used to to people, okay, I only want like 3 centimeter long radishes, and the tops have to be perfect. And for me, it's as a chef, if it tastes the best, I don't care what size it is, what it looks like, you should be able to process it into something that looks beautiful or tastes beautiful. It took us a while to get there with the farmers because they weren't used to that, and they're like, oh, tell us what you want. We're like, no, you tell us what you have. And so it took a little more work on that on their side, but in the end they were able to actually sell us stuff that they couldn't sell to anyone else, because I remember going to this farm before we opened, and it was kind of late winter, and the whole ground of the barn was just covered with these perfect carrots that were like 10 centimeters long, and no one wanted them because they were the wrong size. And I said to ask the farmer, I said, ask, I pick one up, wash it off, and ate it. It was amazing. I said, I'll take every single one of these next year. And it inspired a dish. And for me, it's still one of the best dishes we've ever done. And it's like on the menu at In Situ now in San Francisco. And it's like the quintessential dish that has so much meaning of how we work at the restaurant. So that was a new way of working for us. And you also, here, you have a direct line to the farmers. I mean, most of our farmers deliver the food to the back door. There's no middleman. So you can have this conversation every other day when they come that's like, oh, yeah, so, yeah, yesterday it seemed like the strawberries were a bit watery. And they're like, oh, yeah, because it rained. And, you know, if you wait a few days and it dries out, though, the flavor will come back. And so you have these conversations every day with them, or what's coming up next week. Next week we'll have this. So it's not like call this guy calls that guy, there's something lost in translation. It's like a direct line to the farmers.
If there was one thing that you would like to see happen here in the next 10 years in the restaurant community, what would that be?
I would love to see everyone kind of go in the direction that we're going and have sustainability and kind of this consciousness of your waste kind of become common practice, because I think we're such a small restaurant community that we definitely have the potential for this to happen here, and with the sense of collaboration that goes on within the city, I think that it's possible. I think it's going to take a few years. I mean, 10 years is a good time frame, but I think if it happens in Copenhagen, what happens here now really affects what happens in the world of gastronomy. People are really looking to Copenhagen right now, but that would definitely be my dream. As if we become the city that not only has great restaurants, but we have restaurants that are responsible.
Do you feel like you're building your own Christiania?
A little bit. We're like the Wild West out there a little bit. We kind of like big bonfires every night. And so I think eating seasonally, I think, is the next kind of step to get people on board, the general public, that is.
I only eat hemp and apples this time of year.
You're my dream customer.
What is it like eating hemp? Because I've certainly never done it. And why would you eat it?
It's the flavor of hemp is really interesting. It's the flavor profile definitely falls in like the same as like oregano or marjoram or something like that. And it really has an amazing, we used to make cakes out of it. So cook the hemp in butter and then use the butter to make cakes. I don't know where I learned that from. but the flavor that comes through is really interesting. And people don't, when people eat it, they don't know what it is. They're like, wow, this is really, it's really like herbaceous. And they can't, until you tell them, they're like, oh yeah. But there's only one person in Denmark now that's allowed to grow it for consumption. And unfortunately, we can't use it anymore because he's not certified organic and we're a certified organic restaurant. But I had a conversation with him last month, because he called me and he said, yeah, I talked to this guy who's also growing hemp to make clothes out of. And he said he was selling you guys hemp for the restaurant. And I said, no, we've only ever bought hemp from you. That was last year. And he's like, well, just be careful because he's not licensed to sell it to as an edible. And because obviously you can't have any THC in it. And so it was interesting. It's like this farmer hemp this hemp farmer battle that don't buy it from him and don't buy it from him. And,
very similar to what's happening behind us here in Pusher Street.
Exactly.
Yeah, I can smell it.
Yeah.
Mom, I know you're probably listening, so no, we didn't buy any weed. And since our visit, I'm sad to report that some things have changed in a really big way. We recorded this interview back in early August. A few days later, violence erupted on Pusher Street when a 25-year-old gunman, a suspected drug dealer, shot two police officers and a bystander. He was not a resident of Christiania, but his actions will have lasting effects on the community. Residents of Christiania have since torn down the market stalls selling hash and may now be compelled by the Danish government to introduce video surveillance. Thank you so much to Matt Orlando and Lars Hinnerskoff Eriksson, our Munchies Denmark editor, for welcoming me into Copenhagen and helping me navigate the wild world of Christiania, especially with a bout of jet lag. We're just getting started in this amazing city, so check back in 2 weeks when our Copenhagen Chronicle continues. In the meantime, check out all of our delicious Munchies content over at munchies.tv. Hit us up at Munchies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook too. And if you like the show, go rate us on iTunes because it actually helps us out. I'm Helen Holliman. I'll catch you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.